Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, I spent last week checking out a couple of burger joints in Manhattan.
Uh-huh.
A couple of which I was with you and a couple of which I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But it was something I wanted to discuss with our audience. You know, people are always asking me for good burger places. That's,
uh-huh.
that's one of those things that people are always talking about.
Of course, the best burger place, of course, is Stage Left Restaurant.
Yeah. Okay, so I was in the city and decided to try a bunch of the burger places, and some I've had before and some I haven't, but I figured I'd try them in close proximity to one another so I would have a good memory of which I preferred. And I went to three different places. I went to a place called Burger, B-R-G-R.
That was with me.
Uh-huh. I went to the Shake Shack, which is Danny Meyer's place.
That was with me after we had been at two restaurants prior to that. You made me go in the freezing
cold.
In
Madison Park, yeah. Exactly.
You sacrificed for your art.
I am dedicated to my profession. What can I tell you?
We had two dinners. Okay. All right.
And then the other one was a place called Good Burger, of which there are four different locations throughout Manhattan. And what I'll tell you is, in the last 5 or 10 years, the burger places in Manhattan have gotten significantly better.
Sure. And nationally, you have In-N-Out Burger, which is
of course.
There.
But I was pleasantly surprised. And again, I've tried these places individually at one time or another, but I was pleasantly surprised by each of these places. There, and I'll tell you, my favorite burger of all the places was at Burger, B-R-G-R. My second favorite was probably Shake Shack, and then my third favorite was Good Burger. But what I'll tell you is, they were much closer than I thought they would be to one another as far as how good they were.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what I'll tell you. Here's the best way that I could describe it. If I were close to one, no matter which one it was, I would probably go to the closest one.
Okay.
That's how close I think these were relatively.
What if McDonald's were closer?
Well, that takes me to my next point. The Good Burger that I went to just day before yesterday is about four doors away from a McDonald's.
Uh-huh.
And as I sit there and I look at the difference in quality of these two places, first of all, Good Burger didn't take very long. Maybe I waited 3 or 4 minutes or 5 minutes tops
mm-hmm.
to get my food, where at McDonald's I wait 2 minutes. Okay,
mm-hmm.
so the difference wasn't very great there. The Good Burger burgers ran between $5.75, $6.25. Most of these burgers fell in that range.
Uh-huh.
And I sit there and I look at the comparison of, let's take the premium burger at Burger King and McDonald's, the Angus burger or whatever they're doing, or the with the mushrooms or whatever that burger is, which is, you know, $4 to $5 in Manhattan. And I sit there and I say, you're going to spend $4 on the premium Angus burger at McDonald's when for $5.75, four doors down, there's something that so blows it out of the water. There's no contest here. This is, you know, most of these places I believe use fresh, never frozen meat. At least that's the way it tasted to me. They're real burgers that where they take a temperature when you order the burger about if you want it rare, mid-rare.
Non-microwaved.
Never microwaved. I mean, the difference between these places, I can't believe that anybody in New York City would ever be in a McDonald's when. And obviously it's marketing, and obviously it's. But why would you ever go to a McDonald's when these places are so close and so much better?
I think it's just that, you know, while more and more people are thinking about their food, there are a lot of people that just don't, and it's sad to me. You know, you were talking about your recent trip to Florida. You know, when you're in Central Florida, and there just wasn't anything but
right.
the chain restaurants, and you know,
that's all there is.
That's all. That's
there
it.
Is no choice.
And if we're not careful, everybody. So support your local independently owned restaurants.
There's some bad movie where Taco Bell owns every some futuristic bad movie where Taco Bell owns everything and everything's some subsidiary.
I have a bad independently owned. Not saying all independently owned places are great. I have a bad independently owned story a little bit later. But to speak to your point, I can't understand for the life of me why. Now look, say you like McDonald's and Burger King burgers. Okay, they spend a lot of money to make sure that we have them when we're babies, so that we try and like them.
Yeah,
if
exactly.
You look at it, I look at my food and I think about food, and I used to eat McDonald's burgers until I read Fast Food Nation, and I literally since I've read Fast Food Nation, how many years is that? 8, 9 years ago now?
It's probably 6 or 7. Yeah,
I have not set foot in a fast food restaurant. Well, I've set foot in, but I haven't ordered fast food.
Sadly, I can't say the same, but rarely.
But I opened that burger, and I looked at this microwaved piece of thing that tastes the same every time, no matter where you are. And I realized that it's because they make as flavorless a burger as you can, and then they put artificial, or they put, I don't want to say artificial, then they put flavoring on it to make them all taste the same no matter where you are. And they microwave the burger in the bun. And I thought to myself, okay, this is terrible.
Uh-huh.
This is terrible. So when given the option of a Burger King or a McDonald's, and an unknown place I've never heard of that sells burgers next door, I'm going to go to the unknown place
because sure.
There's a chance that it's something different and something good.
Can I tell you something?
Yeah.
Just simply being able to get my burger medium rare was such a, and basically these places are fast food. Okay,
mm-hmm.
they're it's 4 or 5 minutes. You got your food, and 10 minutes it's gone, and you're out the door in 15 minutes.
Right.
I mean that's what the places are, but. Being able to say medium rare and get an actual medium rare burger in as fast food, it's almost foreign. I mean, I remember when I was a little kid, you could ask in a McDonald's to get a medium rare burger and they would make it for you.
Yeah.
But that's not even a possibility anymore.
Well,
okay,
you know,
they won't even allow you to do that anymore.
You know, it's funny because the microwave is very hard to hit medium rare in a microwave. I'll tell you that much. Well, you know, the other thing is in inexpensive steakhouses. I was in a Lone Star Steakhouse. I ordered a medium rare burger. They wouldn't make it.
Yeah,
wouldn't make it. And they're like, "Oh, well, that's illegal." I said, "No, that's
right.
Not illegal. I happened to own a restaurant in New Jersey." It's like, "Well, at Lone Star, you can't get a medium rare burger. It's unhealthy." I'm like, "Well, it's unhealthy if your meat is crap."
Right.
But if your meat is good meat, it's not. It's you know, what
or,
you're
well,
saying
not
is,
if your meat is crap, if there's crap on the meat, though.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's
well, what really you're saying, what you're saying is, you know, we want to serve you. I'm not going to be careful with this meat at all. So it has to be done done well.
And that's the idea. The idea is that nobody has to be careful with
but
it.
But there are more and more, thank heaven, we're being more and more aware of our food. If you have a local burger place in your neighborhood, you have to go to it. You have to support it.
So for those of you traveling to New York City or going to New York City, where the shake is more important than the burger,
uh-huh.
I will tell you, Shake Shack was the clear winner there. Good Burger was a very good second, and Burger was an okay third. I probably wouldn't have the shake at Burger again. Though, again, all monumentally better than anything you could possibly get at McDonald's or Burger King or one of the fast food places.
All right, now on a sadder note, I have to share with you a story that you don't know. I called you up the other day. We were off on Monday, and I asked if you wanted to go have lunch at a Stewart's Root Beer. And for those of you not in the area, Stewart's Root Beer is a root beer stand.
Well, you see them in your supermarkets now.
But
basically, Stewart's Root Beer was the last place where the car hops would come to your car on roller skates.
Right, exactly.
It was the last vestige of that happy days kind of root beer stand.
And there are still Stewart's Root Beers. Most of them, I think, are independently owned. There's one down the... We say in Jersey, down the shore on Route 37 in Tom's River. There's another one in East Brunswick or around East Brunswick somewhere. We stopped in on the way to the farm.
There's one not too far from here on Route 27.
And there's one on 27 not too far from here. So I was very surprised to see near my house in Edison, New Jersey, a Stewart's Root Beer. They're done up with a specific orange color, and there's a style that the Stewart's Root Beer are done. So, you know, you get a hot dog or maybe a cheeseburger, inexpensive. And the root beer is on tap. They're famous for the root beer on tap, which you can now get in bottles. I've driven by it many times. I wanted to go. You turned me down. I went by myself with a book. How sad am I? And I went and I wanted to get a couple of hot dogs and a root beer at Stewart's Root Beer. I'm at Stewart's Root Beer. I walk in, and as I park in the parking lot, I realize something's a little strange. The Stewart's Root Beer, which is the aesthetic, as we told you, of like the car hop counter place. Some of them are winterized now. There's a crystal chandelier hanging in the window. Well, it's not really crystal. It's faux crystal chandelier hanging
crystal
in the window.
Crystal-like.
And I walk in, and I realize, and there's no counter. There's only tables, and it says Stewart's Root Beer and Diner. So I can only imagine the history of this place is some Greek people bought it and had the Stewart's Root Beer name and made it a Spanakopita is on the Stewart's Root Beer menu. This is unnatural. It shouldn't be. So I sit down and inside it's sort of a Stewart's and sort of a New Jersey
diner,
Greek diner. And I sat down and I was I really wrestled with whether I was going to stay or not, and I sat down and I ordered a couple of dogs and a root beer, and in the final insult to injury, almost false advertising, you know what they brought me?
What?
A bottle of Stewart's root beer.
Yeah.
In the Stewart's root beer. It should be on tap.
Yep. Well, I remember the Stewart's here, that's here close to Rutgers University here, just outside of New Brunswick. I remember, because I lived in South Brunswick right after we graduated college. And we used to go to Stewart's and buy root beer. We'd buy a half gallon of root beer and bring it back home.
Yeah.
And they'd run it out of the tap for you, and there it was. Well, in that time period, I remember going, and all of a sudden they had switched to a soda gun. And I said, well, what happened? And they said, Stewart's no longer makes those barrels. Like, you know how, a keg of beer. You would get a barrel of Stewart's root beer, and you would tap it the same way. Well, no longer is, from what I understand, no longer is Stewart's doing that. So that's a part of United States lore now. It's gone.
So disappointed. Although there are some great root beers in the country, Steve's, and there are some other really good root beers in the country. But I remember we've had root beer on tap in the restaurant briefly. We had it on one of our beer taps, and that didn't go over so big. People like the alcohol in the beer. but you know, not only did they serve me Stewart's root at the Stewart's root beer / Greek diner, they served me in a glass with ice, and I thought. No, 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 a mug. No ice and a mug. What the heck is going on here? Give me a hot dogs and I'm leaving. And I'll never go back again.
Yeah.
So sad.
It's over. It's over. It's not the thing we remember when we were kids.
There we are with the hot dog stories. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. This is Mark and Francis, and our guest today is Susan McKenna Grant. Susan is Canadian by birth. She's founder of a computer graphic company called Alias Research, but she moved to Europe, and she now owns and operates La Petraia, an azienda agricola and agriturismo in Italy, a farm that she operates. And her book is Piano, Piano, Pieno.
Susan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me.
So, Susan, we found out about your book from a couple of sources at the same time, but one of them was you emailed us. Evidently, you're a Restaurant Guys listener.
I've been listening to you guys the internet for years now, so I'm one of your big fans.
Well, that's great.
We've been reading your book now for about a couple months, and now we're one of your big fans.
Great. Just if you break out into Christmas carols, Mark, I'm going to have a problem with it. So let's tell everyone your story. Let's tell our listeners your story. Of course, you can find the book at our website, as you always can, at restaurantguysradio.com. But piano, 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 first of all, what does it mean?
Slowly, slowly, full.
And that's a traditional Italian saying. It's not just three words joined together by you.
I think it's one I made up.
Aha, so it is.
But it's kind of a homage, I guess you might say. It's to the slow food movement. Which has really been something. I've been a member of Slow Food for almost a decade and been very inspired by what they do in Italy. Most of what I know about Italian food I've learned in one way or another through Slow Food. And so it was really just sort of a play with, you know, because slow food is, slow is an English word, and it was a play with that. And also it was just a little bit of a joke about describing the experience that I had moving from North America to Italy, from a rather fast-paced life to a much slower-paced life, and
Susan,
becoming slowly filled with that experience.
Susan, you realize if you had written that book here in the United States, it would have been called Fully, Fully Fast.
Yeah.
Now, let's talk about your life story. Before we get to the book, it's a very interesting story. You did not grow up in an Italian immigrant home. Your connection to Italy was, you know, you found it sort of later in life. You're not an Italian immigrant. You didn't grow up in Italy, yet you moved to Italy with your husband and operate a traditional farm there. That's kind of an unusual course, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm what they call a reverse immigrant. And something that they really, the immigration department in Italy really didn't really know what to do with. Just the idea that I wanted to move to Italy to farm was a very strange concept.
So how was it retreated? How were you received? What did they do? How did the people receive you there?
Well, it's taken some time, you know, to convince people, first of all, that we just weren't there to be tourists, to be there for the holidays, to have a holiday home there, which so many people do. That we were actually, I was actually moving there to live and to work as a farmer. And more than that, to restore a spectacular old property that had been abandoned as a working farm for 50 years. And so it's taken us some time. We've been there 8 years now. And we've worked really, really hard on this restoration project. And I think just the work that we've done on the property, the local people now realize that we are there full time and we are serious and we're bringing some things back. We're bringing some things back that, we're in danger of being lost. And so sometimes I think it takes a foreigner to come to a place because you see things that local people maybe don't. You know, and you appreciate them in a way that it's hard to do if you've been born in a place and lived there all your life. You sometimes take these things for granted, you know.
Well, I think anybody who's done any kind of project on their home or their property can have a small piece of understanding of what you're going through. But you're talking about renovating over 100 acres.
Yeah. Yes, 165 acres. The farm is, and it had not been touched for 50 years. So, and not only that, we're the highest farm in the Chianti Classico zone. So we have an altitude challenge where we are. They call us a disadvantaged farm.
Who calls you that?
The government, the Italian government.
Is that because you're American? Or Canadian?
No, because of our altitude.
I'm just kidding.
And so it was a very challenging property. There were stone terraces that on the property, beautiful old stone terraces where they had originally planted orchards that we didn't even know were there when we bought the place because they were just covered over with 50 years of growth. And once we started removing that growth, we discovered these beautiful old terraces that anymore in Chianti, they just bulldoze. Mm-hmm. To make more room for vineyards. And we've spent years restoring those old terraces by hand, drywall terraces and planting them. And it's just been such an interesting journey because in doing that, I think, you know, the property, in restoring the property, it's had a chance to speak to us. And in doing this restoration, we've discovered so many things that grow there, that old irrigation systems that had been in place, old viaducts, you know, stone viaducts that we've restored for draining the land. And just the places had a chance to speak to us, I think. And we've been able to listen because we've had to take a long time to do this because it's a fairly large project. In Italy, you have to get so many different permissions before you can do anything, and so we've had long periods of waiting for permissions before we could get work started. And that's, again, sort of another reason why I called the book Piano, 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 because we were, in a sense, forced into this.
Everything in Italy moves a little slower than it does here.
Yeah.
But now you chose this property up on the mountain and obviously for, you know, it's beautiful at the top of Chianti and that's one of the great perks. But one of the other reasons that you stated choosing this particular property was not having to worry about where the water was coming from. You were at the top of that cycle.
Yes, exactly. We're not getting any runoff from any other farms, and so that was one of the criteria that we were.
Well, and that's important. And that's important because you want to remain pesticide free and have more
control
over what comes into your land. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the great moments in the book is you talk about discovering this property, and why don't you talk to us about a Canadian woman in Tuscany who comes to the end of the road and you go further.
Yeah, well, we the way we discovered the farm is that We were with a really crazy Australian real estate agent, and he took us 2 kilometers up this basically mule track, and he stopped the car, and he said, "The house, the farm is another kilometer up this road, but usually when I get this far, people tell me to turn around because of the condition of the road. They don't care what's at the end of this road." Well, we are Canadians, and you know, Canada is a big country, and there's lots of dirt roads. And he was an Australian, and the same thing. And we said, you know, carry on up the road. And when we got up to the end of the road, we couldn't really believe what we found there. It was a paradise. It had it just offered us everything that we were looking for. Now, today, when I look back at the pictures we took when we first bought the property, I can't believe we actually did it, because it looks like the haunted house in Psycho. but it really did have so much promise, that the property. And,
so did you have to rebuild the road even?
Yes, we did. We put in a new road. And we had to fence the entire property. We've got 7 kilometers of fence line, because once again we're up way up high, and we're surrounded by woods, and there's all kinds of animals. So before we could plant anything, we had to fence, because there's wild boar and deer and hare and any. In fact, our very first vintage, which was 3 years ago, was completely eaten by wild boar, because they found a little hole in the fence and they got in one night, just about 2 days before we were planning to take the grapes off, and ate everything. So
I know how you can get even with the wild boar.
Yeah.
Supper.
Yeah, we do that.
Because grape-fed wild boar. That doesn't sound any better than that to me.
Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment with Susan McKenna-Grant talking more about her book, Piano, Piano, Piano. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and WCTCAM.com.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient, right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa? You can get a foot massage.
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and 3 world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
On the practical side again, it's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport, there's a direct train from New Brunswick, and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website, ask for the Restaurant Guys promo, or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Susan McKenna-Grant about her book, Piano, 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 about the farm and agriturismo she owns and operates in Tuscany. Now, Susan, you're Canadian. You move into a very difficult, very beautiful property in Tuscany. What exactly was your plan to do there? I mean, did you think going in from the outset that you could make an economically viable farm that could sustain itself ecologically and economically and make it work?
Yes, that's the pipe dream. and really that's one of the big things that we are trying to do there. You know, farming today is very different. We are a very small mixed farm, because although we do have 165 acres, only 25 of those are arable land. The rest is forest. And so we're very small, and we are a mixed farm. We have bees, and we have vineyards and olives, and we have all kinds of animals and orchards and vegetable gardens. We're almost entirely self-sufficient. And today, you know, to do that, you have to really have many, many spokes in your wheel. And one of the things that we're really trying to do at La Petraia is to set an example that, yes, it is possible to create wealth in a sustainable way. And by wealth, I don't mean, you know, tons of money. I mean a good life and an economically viable life. And, you know, so we have lots of spokes in our wheels. We have an agriturismo. We have four guest rooms. We have a fine dining restaurant. We have a cooking school. We have, you know, grapes for wine. We have honey. We make lavender oil. I write, you know, I've written one book. I'm working on another book. My husband runs a financial business in Canada, and so that we have all these different spokes. It's no longer possible today, I don't think, to approach small-scale mixed farming the way it was, you know, 50 years ago. But I think it can be done.
Well, and you're also in an area of Chianti where basically all that's grown are grapes at this point, correct?
Nobody is doing what we're doing. Nobody is. And you know, in Italian, the word for a farmer is contadino, and there are none left in our area. I mean, you know, the local people joke with me that I'm the only one. You know, it is a monoculture there, just like it is anywhere now in the world, and so we are really. That's really our objective.
Now, I think it's interesting that you talk about them pointing to you as being the remaining farmer. In that area, you talk a lot about in your book about the many things that you're doing. One of them is restoring the old recipes that are traditional, that in some ways are no longer made. And you relate in your book how, you know, I think it was the mayor of the town was over for dinner and he said, you know, God, I haven't had the dishes that you're making since I saw my grandmother make them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does a Canadian transplant with no Italian background come in to Italy, to Tuscany, and start reviving these dishes? I mean, you have a cooking school in Tuscany and you're not, well, Tuscan. I mean, I guess you are now, but you weren't originally. That's an interesting thing. How are the locals receiving your restoring of those traditions, and how are you doing it?
Well, doing it's pretty easy. It's just, you know, it's just research, and that's something when in the early years when we were restoring the property before we opened, I had all kinds of time to do that. We have an old camper van, and I spent a couple of years in that thing, just traveling from one end of the country, really, from Tuscany north. The recipes in the book aren't strictly Tuscan, but one of the things that just fascinates me about Italy is how varied the food is from region to region, from town to town. And there are so many endangered recipes that are people just aren't, and foods, you know, cheeses and all kinds of things that are falling by the wayside, and but they're still being made and they're still being produced, and you can find them. And so I love that I loved that whole experience of tracking this stuff down.
Now living there, do you talk about how a lot of these traditions have sort of fallen by the wayside? Are the local people willing to seek you out, maybe pay a premium for their bread or their preserved foods or the things that you offer to sell? Are people sort of jazzed about the idea of buying from the local farm again?
Yeah, they're starting to. You know, one of the things that we, just to give you an example of that, we raise this rare breed of pig. It's called a Cinta Senese. It's a beautiful black pig with a white belt around its neck, and it followed a fashion in the 70s when we all started to become concerned about eating too much fat, because this pig can only live in a forest. It can't live in a stall. It needs for each pig, you need about half a hectare of land. And
that's about an acre.
Yeah, exactly. And it eats acorns and chestnuts. And
sounds
so
delicious.
Every farm in the province of Siena, it's called the Cinta Senese, which means the belted pig from Siena, used to have one or two of these pigs, and they'd slaughter them at Christmas. And then gradually, when the fear of fat came in, you know, in the 70s, people started changing and raising the great white instead. Now, this is a pig that can live in a stall and can come to term in a lot shorter period of time. And so there was only one stubborn breeder left raising these pigs, and he's managed to bring the whole breed back. There's now several hundred of these pigs once again.
There's a guy who should get a medal, huh?
Pardon me? Exactly, yeah. So when we first bought the place, we have oak and chestnut forests, and I was really excited about that because this is perfect for these pigs. And all of the local people, they just said to us, you're crazy to think about those pigs. Their meat is way too expensive. You know, if you go into a butcher shop to buy prosciutto from a Cinta Senese, it's 80 or 90 euros a kilo, whereas Parma ham is, you know, maybe 18 or 19. So it's 4 or 5 or 6 times the price. And that just made no sense to these people. But we went ahead and did it anyway. And now, you know, we have friends that were the very same friends who were, you know, sort of shaking their finger and telling us, no, who are raising these pigs themselves?
That's great.
Because they came to our house, they tasted the meat, they found it delicious, and so...
How many of these pigs do you have?
We have 2.
And they're allowed pretty much...
A year.
And they're pretty much allowed to the run of a section of the forest?
Yeah, we fence in. We have to fence them in, but we fence them into about a hectare of land. And we have to fence them in because if we don't, the wild boar...
That's what I was going to ask you.
...breed with them. And so we fence them in, but they've got a hectare of acorn forest. And then in the fall, when our chestnut forest produces, you know, when the chestnuts fall, we go and we harvest those chestnuts and bring them to the pigs. And then in January, we kill them.
So. Wow, it sounds like you're kind of nice to them until the very end.
Yeah.
I bet they feel betrayed.
Now, you're also eating the wild boar, you're also eating the wild hare, you're also eating some of the other things that the land is giving you, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. There's in hunting season, which starts in late August and goes right through till the end of January, it's a great time of the year, and often there'll be a knock on the kitchen door, and usually it's when we're right in the middle of service, and there will be a hunter there with a couple of pheasants or, you know, a hare, and you have to deal with it, you know, right then and there. So we are rich with game.
So I have to say one of the things that's really admirable and striking and I think it leaves a lot of readers scratching their heads is, and I sort of touched on this earlier, is so you're a Canadian woman who goes to Italy, chooses Italy to adopt as a country and embraces it in a way. You didn't move to a large city and spend your evenings at the opera. You moved in, took over a business that is an intensely local business. I mean, did you speak Italian fluently when you went there? What was the transition like? Well, what was the transition like for you? It was a brave...
It was hard. It was really hard. We had many days when we would wake up and tear out our hair and think that we were stark raving mad. And, you know, to be quite honest with you, we still have those days. It's not been easy. However, nothing in life is easy that's worth doing. And on the other side of that coin, it's been such an incredible journey, and it's been such a privilege to live on this piece of land and to have had this experience that it's been worth all of the struggle.
Well, Susan, you know, I'm going to ask, you know, you must believe in reincarnation, because what you're doing is what most people say they're going to do in their next life.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What now do you intend to live out your days there?
We've not made any big plans like that, but I'll tell you, it's a very difficult place to leave. And when we first bought the property, I you know, was so excited because I thought, I'm here, I'm living in Italy, I'm living in Europe, I'm going to be able to travel all over and go here and go there. And I did that for a little while. But, you know, now these days, the past few years, it's really hard for me to find the motivation to leave the property. We just have so much going on there, and it's such an incredible place that I do find it difficult to leave. So I suspect we're going to be there for a while.
I feel like we haven't given our listeners the full import of how you're living your life there. I mean, almost all the food you eat, almost everything you consume comes from right around you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the 100-meter diet.
I mean, here in the United States, people talk about a 100-mile diet, and it is a difficult. I mean, people who want to live that type of lifestyle, it's very difficult.
Yes.
But you've taken that kind of to the nth degree.
If people want to come and visit you, where can we direct them?
Like me.
If people want to visit you and their partner will let them off, where can they?
We have a website. It's lapetraya.com, and we're in Radin Chianti, right in the heart of the Chianti Classico zone.
Well, we're going to put a link to La Petraia on the website, and of course, if you go, tell Susan that the restaurant guy sent you. But we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the book and the recipes in the book that you can find from Susan McKenna Grant in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com and WCTCAM.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're speaking with Susan McKenna Grant about her wonderful book, Piano, 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 detailing her life in Tuscany as a transplant from Canada to Tuscany. Talk to us about this book. You know, one of the things that I see in cookbooks overall and in cocktail books overall, people are hungering no longer for just a collection of recipes. People seek those recipes and that food to be contextualized, to get an understanding of the food.
They want to know why you collected these recipes.
Well, and you know that there's been a very beneficial marriage in books about food, that most memoirs and stories about food or about a place contain recipes. And most cookbooks contain an element of memoir and story. Is this a cookbook? Is this a memoir? It strikes me as something right down the middle.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a storybook with recipes. I've always believed that food tastes better, and I think it can do more for you if it has a story to go with it, if it has some context.
But I think context is king in a book.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think it gives you a reason to want to cook it in the first place, and then when you serve it to your family or your friends, it gives you a story to tell them. And these are the traditions, these are the things that we're losing.
It's funny.
Food has no story anymore, just like our agriculture has no culture anymore.
Well, you know, that's funny that you speak about having a context for food, and with a collection of recipes, I think that, you know, your grandmother may have handed your mother, or your great-grandmother may have handed your grandmother a collection of written recipes on an index card. But the context came from, you know, generations of culture passed on from usually mother to daughter within the context of a family. And so the context was the meals of your whole life and your family's life, and that was the food of your people. Well, you know what? We've lost that, and I think a lot of people learning to cook now didn't learn from their mother, or their mother didn't learn from their grandmother. And I think we're hungry for that contextualization of food.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely, I think that's now, you're, so important.
You mentioned, we were talking a little bit before the show, and you said that your book was published first in Canada, and it was a little more difficult to get it published in the United States.
It took us a couple of years to get it published here.
Well, you said something that I thought was very true, and you said, well, you know, it's not 30-minute meals or how easy can you make it, and it's got a lot of story to it. And, you know, I think there's this great tendency to say, okay, well, here it is. It's great food made easy. And it's not just about being easy and being done in 30 minutes.
Yeah. And, you know, it's true, absolutely. And the recipes in this book are really easy. I really tried to make them easy because that's the way Italians cook, you know, and they do cook things in less than 30 minutes. And the focus, of course, is on the ingredients. And in most of the recipes, I tried to limit the list of ingredients to 6. Now, there are some that have more than 6, but the majority have 6 or less, and they can be made in a short period of time. But more importantly than that, most of these recipes are traditional recipes that, like you say, they have been handed down from mother to daughter, from family to family for generations. And there's something nutritious. There's a nutritious element to that. There's something I think that we need on our plates besides the food.
Well, obviously, having 165 acres there and being able to grow a lot of your own food really, you know, enhances all of this. There's a quote that was kind of buried in the book that I want to bring out. And what it is best gets better when you grow your own.
Yeah.
And I just love that quote because until someone has had that tomato that they nurtured and grew in their backyard or on their farm or wherever and picked it and used it, I don't think you completely understand what that means.
No, it's, and this is the other thing that I've realized now, cooking there for the last few years in the restaurant, and we run an internship program. We bring in a number of different young chefs every season. And one of my big jobs every year is just teaching them. It's a whole different way of cooking, you know. You need, when you go out and you're working with really fresh ingredients, you have to learn a whole new approach to cooking. You don't need to season things nearly as much.
Well, and you also need to, when you work with fresh ingredients and seasonal ingredients, you need to be sensitive to the fact that your tomatoes this week may be different than your tomatoes last week. And you really need to be in tune with the changing nature of ingredients rather than standardized ingredients. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, if you had to pick one recipe for us to talk about, and of course our listeners can pick up the book at restaurantguysradio.com, but what would you say is one of the most striking or surprising recipes in Piano, Piano, Piano from your perspective?
Striking or surprising? Well, there's a lot of them. One of the recipes that I really love at this time of the year is the pizza curry recipe, which is a buckwheat, homemade buckwheat noodle with cabbage and potatoes and cheese. But again, too, like, there's a lot of great bread recipes in the book, and I think the focaccia is a wonderful recipe for people who are into making bread.
Well, will you give us permission to post a couple of those recipes on the website?
Absolutely. Yes.
Well, if you go to restaurantguysradio.com, you can get a little insight. We'll post those two recipes. We'll post a bread recipe as well. We'll post those two recipes up on the site. And we'll also post a link to where you can go and visit Susan McKenna Grant yourself.
Yeah, there were some great things in this book. I mean, just little tidbits, little things that I think a lot of other recipe books leave out. I mean, just a little tidbit on, you know, if you're using chlorinated water, you're going to affect the taste of the bread that you make.
Yeah.
I just think there's a lot of little tidbits like that in this book that really add a lot.
The book begins with a fairly substantial bread chapter, and I really feel that that's where I begin to plan my meals, and I really felt that it was a subject that's often ignored in general purpose cookbooks. You know, we have special bread books, but bread's not that hard to make, and it's something that is fun to do, and it doesn't really take a lot of time. And so there's a lot of great bread recipes in this book, and I've had a lot of great feedback from people who have enjoyed that chapter.
And if you'd like to learn more, you can pick up the book yourself. It's called Piano, Piano, Piano by Susan McKenna Grant. And we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on WCTCAM.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking and at the same time rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine. wine that speaks of the very essence of Friuli from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolit? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis.
Early in the show, we were talking to Susan, and she said something that was really, really eloquent. And we just kind of went past it because we moved on to the next topic. But I think it really speaks of how she's living her life and how she's making the world a better place. What she said was, just like agriculture has no culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. Agriculture has become agribusiness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so there is no more culture in agriculture anymore. And because of it, our food is worse, our lives are a little bit worse, and certainly the way we live our life is a little bit worse.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and it's important. I think the work she's doing is important, but I mean, let's be clear about, and she's doing important because she's showing us a way, she's showing us mm-hmm. a sustainable way, but how to get there right now. Frankly, you have to be a person with a significant amount of resources to buy 160 acres in Tuscany. You know, and that was something that, you know, the wealth traditionally was passed from father to son or from father to daughter or father, mother, daughter in the land. And you know what? Maybe you were land rich and you didn't make, a killing and you had a lot of wealth in your land. But the idea was that was the trust. That was the thing that provided you with a living going forward. Very hard to establish something like that. Because, let's be honest, I don't know, and I probably should have asked her about this, but I think that if Susan McKenna Grant had wanted to invest her resources elsewhere, whatever she's invested into making that property work, where she's making a sustainable environment, where she can basically buy herself a job where she has a great way of life and is doing important things, she could have invested elsewhere in an easier way. I got to tell you, I know I've mentioned it a couple times during the show. You know, we in the United States and in Canada and Australia, we're a culture that is made up of immigrants. So we're used to bringing immigrants in and having, you know, people from all over move next door and take up residence and by the next generation become American or Australian or Canadian. Tuscany, that doesn't happen a lot. You know, it's not a land of immigrants.
And well, especially someone coming in to farm.
Right, exactly.
I mean, that's you know, someone coming in to open a software business or a McDonald's, I think you probably see people doing that all the time, or a gas station. But I don't think it's rare that you see someone moving into Tuscany to be a traditional farmer. And by traditional farmer, I mean not a monoculture.
Yeah,
farmer,
no.
Somebody who is enticed by the romance of making grapes and making wine.
It's a very impressive project. The story is wonderful, and I do intend that we should go visit her in Tuscany next time we're over in Italy.
I count on it.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the last hour as much as we have. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com.